Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon to some of you, I'm sure. It is a delight for me to be able to welcome you all to this new series at Torah in Motion. Dr. Malka Simkovich is a visiting instructor of Jewish Studies at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago. She has a PhD in Second Temple and Rabbinic Judaism from Brandeis University. Her research focuses on universalist Jewish literature from the Roman Empire. She also lectures frequently in the Jewish community in Chicago. And there are new developments recently that I would love to hear about. Sorry, excuse me, would you Dr. Simkovich, would you like to tell us what your current title is?
Yeah, I'm not a visiting instructor, although I was very honored to be hired as one in 2014. I'm the Crown Ryan Chair of Jewish Studies at Catholic Theological Union and the Director of Catholic Jewish Studies at that institution.
Okay.
2014, my research did focus on universalism, but that's a while back, and you can learn more about my work on the CTU website.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. I had a chance to learn a little bit about universalist Jewish literature with you in the summer. So, still a bit. Okay. So I guess you also have, a lot of expertise in early Jewish history, and that's what we're going to be looking at a little bit in this new four-part series on the Jews of ancient Egypt. So I will let you get started with us with that now. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your introduction. It's so wonderful to see all of you today. I know that for some of you it's morning and you're in very frigid weather. I hope you're safe and warm. And for some of you it's the afternoon and you might be in Israel enjoying snow there as well. So I hope that all of you are indoors and comfortable, and I appreciate your taking the time to learn with me this morning. Before we get into the material for today, I'm going to share a very brief syllabus so that if you are planning on joining this class for the next 4 weeks, you'll have a sense of where we're going. So I'm going to share my screen. And here's the syllabus. I'm happy to send this to you over email. If anybody wants a copy of this, you can email me at msimkovich@ctu.edu. Today, we're going to briefly review, it's very hard to review the history of the Jews of Egypt in 6 centuries or so, but we're going to try. And then we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of Jewish life in particular areas of Egypt, beginning with Elephantine, a small island in the Nile of Upper Egypt. We're going to also talk about a temple that was built by pious Jews from Judea in a city called Leontopolis. And the third week of this course will focus on the Jews of Alexandria. You could have a 12-week course on the Jews of Alexandria. I know someone in the chat is very excited about that. It's incredibly rich. Our sources on Jewish life in Alexandria is one of the best attested to communities in the ancient world. And finally, we will discuss in the last class of this series the relationship between Jews who lived in the land of Israel and Jews who lived in Egypt. So this is a very brief overview of what the class is going to look like. And today we have the biggest challenge because to provide a historical overview of what's going on in Egypt from around 515 BCE with the beginning of the Second Temple period to 70 CE with the fall of the temple is an enormous challenge. And we really can't start in 515 BCE. We really have to start in 586 with the fall of the temple. Before I go on, I just want to let you know I will not be reading the chat for the next 45 minutes. That said, feel free to think about your questions, your comments, anything that's confusing to you that you want to discuss. I will leave time for discussion at the end of the hour, but I can't monitor the chat as I lecture. So I would ask that if you have a question, please don't put it in for the next 30 or 40 minutes, but save it because I do want to hear from you. But if I keep seeing notifications on the chat, I'm not going to be monitoring it. So I appreciate your working with me on that. If there's something that I've said that you really, really is totally confusing you and it's going to ruin the rest of your hour because you won't understand anything else, then unmute yourself and just jump in because I won't be checking the chat. And then, like I said, in about 45 minutes, feel free to please start putting your questions and comments in the chat. Okay. The presence of Jews in the land of Egypt in the Persian and Hellenistic era is one of the biggest theological conundrums that Jews in the ancient world have. The fact that these Jews were not only living in Egypt from the end of the Babylonian period all the way through not just 70 CE, but 115, 118 CE, maybe even past that, and the fact that these Jews thrived, succeeded, participated in many aspects of economic, social, and political life. This was a thorn in the side of Jews who lived in the land of Israel. And it was also a challenge to those very Jews who lived in Egypt. If you've heard me speak before, you know something that I like to say in almost every class. There's no distinction in the ancient world between where you lived and how you practiced your Judaism. And so there were Jews throughout the Second Temple period living in Egypt who were very, very pious Jews, among them Philo of Alexandria, the great philosopher, who gets a bad rap as someone who's very Hellenized. But Philo is an observant Jew. He keeps the big three identifying markers of Jewish practice in the ancient world, Shabbat, dietary law, circumcision. He, like tens of thousands of other Jews, maybe hundreds of thousands of other Jews in Alexandria, go to the synagogue regularly where they read their scriptures and they interpret them. There are hundreds of thousands of pious Jews in Egypt. And likewise, there are Jews in the land of Israel who are Hellenized or apostates. So where you lived in the ancient world did not determine your level of piety. And the fact that Jews in Alexandria, Leontopolis, maybe Elephantine, these Jews were producing sophisticated works of biblical interpretation, observing their ancestral laws, going to synagogue, and doing so without an attachment or dependence on the Jerusalem temple and its administrators was a huge problem for Jews in the land of Israel. We all know that Sefer Devarim mandates that once the Israelites arrive in the land of Israel, they cannot go back to Egypt. But it's actually much more complicated. And I want to start this series with a story. The story takes place in the years after 605 BCE, with a battle between the two primary world powers at this time in the ancient Near East, Egypt and Babylonia. In 605, there's a battle. The battle is called the Battle of Carchemish. It's referenced in the Tanakh. And we have Paro of Egypt, Paro Necho, fighting Nebuchadnezzar, also sometimes referred to as Nebuchadrezzar. And in this battle, like so many others in the ancient world, Judea is stuck in the middle. And there's a question of who to ally with. Now, we all know the end of the story. We know Babylonia defeats Egypt, but of course we know that Babylonia invades Judea, Jerusalem, besieges the city, destroys the temple, forces the Judeans out to the eastern regions of the ever-expanding Babylonian Empire. And the Jews who are stuck in Judea, not all Jews were pushed out to Babylonia. It's about an 11 or 12 year process from 597 to 586. And even in 586, there are still Judeans in the land of Israel. And they don't know what to do. Should we flee the Babylonians and try to find refuge in Egypt? Or should we stay and risk the repercussions of our rebellion that are still playing out and suffer under the yoke of Babylonia? And there's a debate. This debate takes place under the rulership of a famous person that I'm sure you've all heard of. His name is Gedaliah. After 586, the governorship of Judea is given to Gedaliah, but of course he's a puppet for the Babylonians. The Babylonians are in control. And Jewish leaders approach one of the most famous prophets of the Judean kingdom, which is now sort of defunct, right? There is no Judean kingdom. And his name is Yirmiyahu. And we have a very well-documented debate between these Judean leaders and Yirmiyahu regarding what the remnant of Judeans should do in 586. Where should they go? Should they stay or should they flee to Egypt? Now, anybody who has read Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, Membet, Memgimel, Memdalid knows this story. But of course, very few of us are intimately familiar with all those deep layers in the middle of Sefer Yirmiyahu. So what I want to do is begin with this debate in 586. I want to begin with Sefer Yirmiyahu, Perek Membet. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I really want to get into the historical realities of Jewish life in Egypt in the Second Temple period. So I'm going to share my screen, which I really hate doing because then I can't see your faces and I need your active facial expressions to keep me going. Like Stephen over there, who is smiling all the way through, and Asher Stein, some people's faces I focus on, Irene. It's very important, Ruth Shane, that she comes to my talks and I find her smiling face, but I'm going to share my screen. So hopefully I'll be able to stay awake. All right, so here we have, you should see my source sheet. You should see a timeline. And again, please save your questions for the end. I will not be checking the chat until about a half an hour from now, at least. Here we have a little map where you can see the communities that I've referred to. When I move my cursor, do you see my cursor? Can someone nod? Yes, okay, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Zella and Glenn Goldfinger, because I see you nodding. All right, so you see Alexandria over there, right? That's a very, very important port city. If you were to go, I'm gonna like go to the top of my screen. If you were to go to from Rome to Jerusalem, you would very likely pass through Alexandria and stop there for a little bit, maybe to replenish your supplies. Very, very important port city. You have Heliopolis, which is another center of Jewish life. And then for many, many centuries until perhaps as early as the 1970s, you have a Jewish community in Fustat, the famous Cairo Kenizzas found there at the Ben Ezra Synagogue. Anyway, going down over here, you have Upper Egypt, which is confusing because Upper Egypt is not in the north of Egypt. You have Elephantine, that island we're going to talk about in a week. And where is Leontopolis? Unfortunately, it is not on this map, but that's okay. We'll talk about that next week as well. All right. So let's go to Yirmiyahu.
Just before we go over to Yirmiyahu, it looks like Sheila Melkman has a burning question. So.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. Oh, Sheila, please. Well, her hand is raised.
Or maybe we can go on.
Let's go on. And then maybe if you don't mind taking a look, if Sheila puts the question in the chat and it needs to be something addressed now, please interrupt.
Okay. Computer.
Okay. Thank you so much. All right. So here we are. I think I'm not going to do this in Hebrew. I for sure can't do it word for word. I assume that most of you are proficient in Hebrew. But I think I'm going to mostly focus this on English, but you can follow along in the Hebrew if you like. Okay, it's never as good in English, but that's okay. All right. The commanders of the forces, no, with all these Hebrew names, I'm not going to do that. Okay. Vayigshu kol sarei chaylim. All these former commanders of the military troops of Judea, of course, they're now under the yoke of Babylonia, Yochanan, Vizania, Ben Hoshaya, and all these other people, remnants who had not been exiled, Kola'am, Mikaton, Vad Gadol, but of course it's a tiny portion of the population at this point because we're already well into the process of exile. They confront Yirmiyahu. What do they say? You have to pray. He's Palel Ba'adenu, El Adonai Elohecha. You have to pray for God on behalf, Ba'ad Kol Hashay Ritazot. Pray on behalf of the remnant that remains in Judea. Because we don't know what to do and we're scared. Nisharnu ma'at me'arbei. We're just this tiny minority in the land of Israel and we don't know what to do. Vayigen lanu adonai Elohecha. It's funny that it says your God. Hashem your God, et haderech asher nilechba, I have to finish the pasuk since I said God's name, et hadavar asher na'aseh, tell us, or have God tell us, where should we go? Whatever God tells us, we'll listen. If God says go to the west, we'll go to the west. If God says go to the east, we'll do that. If he says stay put, we'll listen. And so Yirmiyahu says, fine, hinani mitpalel, I am going to do that right now. And he prays to God, by he miketz aser imim. You see my highlighting, right? When I do that, you see it? Okay. After 10 days, by he devar denial Yirmiyahu, the word of God returns to Yirmiyahu, and God could not be clearer. You are not to go to Egypt. Im shov teishvu ba'eretz hazot uvaniti etchem v'lo eheros unatati etchem v'lo etosh. If you stay put, you will not experience further destruction. Ki nichamti el ara, I'm comforted in light of the evil that you have done and the vengeance that I took upon you. Asher asiti lachem. Etein lachem rachamim. I will be pitiful upon you, but you have to stay put. If you go to Egypt, things are going to be very bad for you. It's always a question for whether I should say Hashem's name, because then I worry about not getting to the end of the pasuk because I'm always interrupting myself. If you go to Egypt, you can't imagine the terrible destruction that will be wrought upon you. That fearsome sword that you are so afraid of, it is going to chase you. You are going to suffer from the sword, from famine, from enemies. It will be bad. There is no ambivalence in this speech from God to the people. Do not go. Anyone who goes will die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. And you might be aware of the end of the story if you have read Mem Gimel. I am going to do the English just to sort of hasten, but again, follow along over here. So the people say, the people respond to this oracle. They say, Sheker atah medaber. They say, lies you are saying to us. You are a false prophet, Yirmiyahu. God did not say, do not go to Egypt to settle there. That clown, the scribe, Baruch ben Neriah, is inciting you. He is a mesit, I think is the Hebrew. Baruch ben Neriah mesit otcha. He is misleading you. He is inciting you so that we can become victims to the Babylonian oppression and yoke. We are going to go down to Egypt. And even though they promise Yirmiyahu, whatever you say, we will obey, in the end, they disobey the prophetic word of Yirmiyahu. And what do? They go to Egypt. And so Yirmiyahu apparently goes with them, and he has a prophecy in Egypt, in Tachpanes. And what is the prophecy? Well, you can imagine that God is not very happy, because God clearly said, do not go to Egypt in the wake of the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. Stay put, and I will protect you under the yoke of Babylonia. Now this remnant has moved from Babylonia to Egypt. And what does God say? Well, I'm going to send Babylonia to Egypt. And what is he going to do? Because these are enemies, remember. Remember Nebuchadnezzar versus Paranacho, right? And the king of Babylonia is going to come and ravage the land of Egypt. And everyone who is destined for pestilence will have pestilence. For captivity will have captivity. For the sword, the sword. And the people who have come from Judea to Egypt are doomed to suffer according to this oracle. So you can read the follow-up on your own in Mem Bet. But God goes on and on through the voice of Yirmiyahu. God is furious. Why do you provoke me to anger with the work of your hands, making offerings to other God in the land of Egypt where you have come to settle? There's no ambiguity here. Will you be cut off and become an object of cursing and ridicule? The fact that you left the promised land where you could have enjoyed the protection of God had you done his will. Now you no longer have that divine protection, and the nations will mock you for it because you have forgotten the crime of your ancestors, of the kings of Judah, of their wives, your own crimes, the crimes of your wives, which they committed in the land of Judah in the streets of Jerusalem. On and on and on and on. And so again, God promises in Mem Daled, I will take the remnant of Judah who has come to Egypt, and they will perish. They will fall in the land of Egypt. this is a really, really painful chapter in the life of Yirmiyahu and the lives of the Judean people. We all think, not all, but I think there's a tendency to assume that the story ends in 586. The temple falls, everybody goes to Babylonia. They suffer for a few decades, 6 or 7 decades, and then under the Persians, they're allowed to go back and rebuild their temple, Vizehu. But the reality is that not all Judeans went to Babylonia. And many of that remnant that stayed end up in Egypt, and they build communities. The big contradiction that we have to struggle with beginning in the Second Temple period is that the prophecy that Yirmiyahu prophesies in Mem Gimel Mem Daled does not happen. The Jews who settle in Egypt do very, very well. So well that they draw migration from other Judean communities. So when the Persians conquer Babylonia in 538, around 538 BC, and they say to the Judeans in the east, in Babylonian exile, go back to the land of Israel and rebuild your temple, those Judeans, many of them actually go to Egypt, where there already are Jews, and they expand those communities. And so Egypt is not just doing well, the Jews of Egypt, they're actually growing and thriving and building. They're building synagogues, they're building communities. So what do you do? What do you do with this very, very dark prophecy against the Jews of Egypt when the reality is things are great, mostly for this Jewish population? Now, I'm going to be very annoying with, I'm going to stop share, because I really try to minimize my sharing. So whenever I can, I'm going to stop share so I can see your faces. What we're going to do in the next 20 or 30 minutes is look at some quite difficult sources that speak to the political, social, and economic success of Jews in Egypt in the broadest sense. Week 2, week 3, week 4, we're going to get into the real details of these particular communities, Leontopolis, Elephantine, Alexandria. But what I want to show in the next 20 minutes is that the Jews succeeded, in particularly on a political level, by which I mean they rise the ranks of politics. And so you have a contradiction that might be very resonant when you think about contemporary Jewish life today. On the one hand, Jews are politically very successful. They're generals in Cleopatra's army. They're supporting Julius Caesar. Some of these sources are absolutely incredible. Josephus almost suggests that Julius Caesar defeats Egypt thanks to the Jews. And yet that same success galvanizes incredible resentment and what we would call anti-Judaism on the part of their Greek and Roman neighbors. And so you have this contradictory situation where the Jews are doing great, and yet there's always the "and yet." There are people writing terrible things about the Jews at the very same time that they're succeeding. Let's look at a few of these sources. I will not get to all of this, but I put in the chat my email, and I'm going to do it one more time for those of you who came on a tiny bit late. You can email me, and I see that you have the source sheet up, but I can also send you. I make tiny little changes all the way up until I begin talking. So if you want the most updated one, you can send me an email. There are a couple of typos and other things. All right, so now I'm back to sharing. We begin with the late first century CE historian Josephus, who witnesses the Jewish war between 66 and 73. He's taken captive by General Vespasian, taken to Rome. Vespasian becomes the emperor. He releases Josephus. He commissions the Flavian family that Vespasian is a part, commissions Josephus to write a history of the Jewish war in the late 70 CE and in the 90 CE. As an old man, Josephus writes this 20-volume work, Antiquities of the Jews, his magnum opus, A History of the Jewish People, beginning with Genesis. In the 12th book of Antiquities, Josephus is telling us the story of the events that led up to the Hasmonean Rebellion in 167 BCE. And I'm going to try to do this as concisely as possible because I don't want to get bogged down into any one source. But I want to point out the degree to which Jewish leaders had political power in Egypt. You have a very pious high priest in Jerusalem in the early 2nd century BCE named Onias. Chonya. And Onias, and I say Chonya because he's referenced in the Mishnah because he ends up building a temple and the Mishnah discusses whether you could offer a sacrifice on this temple. And Chonya, Onias, has a father. His name is Onias as well, Onias 3, and this is Onias 4. Onias is a pious, observant Jew who is driven out by Hellenized claimants to the high priesthood named Menelaus and Alcimus. And these men, especially Alcimus, I'm going to focus on, claims the role of the high priesthood, but he is not from a family of high priests. And Onias realizes that his life is in danger and that he, as a legitimate claimant to the high priesthood, may be assassinated. He knows with this major intra-Jewish debate regarding Hellenization, should we Hellenize, should we not? Of course, this is the setting for the story of Hanukkah. Onias says, it's no longer safe for me to be in Jerusalem. I have to flee before I'm killed. And he says, I'm going to go to Egypt. There are already many, many Jews in Egypt. And what's interesting here is that we always think of Hanukkah as like, well, the Judeans, the Jews in Judea practice the authentic, more pious, less tainted, less corrupted version of Judaism. And the Jews outside in the diaspora, they were less pious. But this story is a great example of how that binary does not hold up. Onias is the pious, observant, God-fearing hero of the story who leaves, who flees Jerusalem while Menelaus and Alcimus tighten their control over the city, and these are Hellenized figures. So Onias goes to Egypt, and he does not want to administrate a synagogue, even though there are plenty of synagogues to lead at this time in the diaspora. Onias, as a priest, says, I want to build a temple. And I think some of you, especially if you've been in my other classes, know that there were other temples in the Second Temple period, other Jewish temples in the diaspora. And these were not built by, heretical apostates. The temple of Onias was built by a God-fearing Jew who felt that the Jerusalem temple was too corrupted to be, at that time, the main legitimate temple. And so he says, I'm going to build a temple in Egypt, and I'm going to build it in a place called the Antopolis, which we're going to discuss more in the coming weeks. But he needs official permission from Ptolemy and Cleopatra to build this temple. And in another part of Antiquities, in the next book, book 13, Josephus, and also in the Jewish War a little bit, Josephus reviews the circumstances in which Onias gets permission from Ptolemy and Cleopatra to build a Jewish temple. And Josephus cites a letter. We don't know if this letter is the exact, perfectly accurate document, or whether Josephus is embellishing or maybe even inventing. But he cites a letter that Onias writes to Ptolemy and Cleopatra. Please know this is not the famous Cleopatra of the late first century BCE, who's in love with Mark Antony, right? There are many Cleopatras. This is Cleopatra. I think it would be the second, I think, but I have to double check. But we're talking the early second century BCE. I'm pretty sure it's the second, because we'll talk about Cleopatra the third later. So Ptolemy and Cleopatra get a letter from Onias, and Onias says, I have to come to Egypt. I'm fleeing for my life, and I want your official permission to build a temple. And I've heard that there is a fortress in a place called, I actually don't know if he says the name over here. Does he say, hold on one second. Many and greater services which I rendered you in the course of the war, with the help of God when I was in Syria and Phoenicia. And he was helping the Ptolemies fight against the Seleucids when I came with the Jews, okay, to the Antopolis. And sorry for that typo. Okay, so he wants to build it in the Antopolis. And he knows that there's a fortress that already exists there that's out of use. It's not in good shape. And he says, I beg you to permit me to cleanse this old temple, this old building. It belongs to no one. It's in ruins. And I want to renovate this structure to the Jewish God. And I'm going to renovate in such a way that it looks like the Jerusalem temple with the same dimensions. And I'm going to do it in honor of you, not in a way that threatens your power, but in a way that pays homage to your authority. So this, the famous accusation against Jews in the diaspora that they have dual loyalty is actually something that Onias really leans into over here. I'm going to build this temple with the same exact dimensions of the Jerusalem temple, but I'm going to do it in a way that honors you. Why? So that the Jewish inhabitants of Egypt can come together in mutual harmony and serve your interests. Allowing us to have this temple will enable us to be unified in our loyalty to you. And then the zinger of this letter is that he cites his biblical scriptures. Onias says to Cleopatra and Ptolemy, our own prophet Isaiah predicted that there has to be a temple of the Jews in Egypt. Can you believe this? Yes, this does exist. He's not making it up. As Isaiah foretold, there shall be an altar in Egypt to the Lord God. And you can look this up. I put in the source in, this might not be in the source sheet that you have because I just added this. It might be, I'm not sure. But if you look up Yeshayahu Yotet, you will see a prediction that the Egyptians will one day, have an altar to the one true God, the Jewish God, and all people will, including the Egyptians themselves, will worship the one true God. This is like a universalist sort of eschatological prediction of the end time that Onias is reading as pertaining directly to his own reality. You'll also find a parallel in Zechariah at the very, very end of Zechariah and Perek Yedaleh, where again, there's a vision of the end time that focuses on the Egyptian recognition of the one true God. The prophets were very, very interested, particularly in the future repentance of the Egyptians, because there's a special, distinctive, unique relationship between the Jews and the land of Egypt that really is different from their relationship with other host cultures. Anyway, so Onias says, look, our prophet predicted that we have to have a temple in Egypt. And so can you please help us to make that happen? And they do. Cleopatra and Ptolemy permit this temple to be built. And this temple is enormously successful. We even have, I should have put in the source sheet. I'm just going to stop here for a second. Today, the site of the temple, and actually I'll talk about this more next week, is called Tel El Yehudia in Egypt. And excavations have been done there and archaeological finds have been absolutely amazing. And Jews lived there for centuries until at least the end of the first century CE. So the community that Onias founds is extraordinarily successful. Again, I want to remind everybody, I'm not reading the comments until the last 10, 15 minutes of class. All right. So why am I sharing the source with you? Because the point is not only that the Jews in Egypt are successful, but that they quickly rise the ranks of political power. And perhaps the best example of this is in the late 2nd century, early 1st century BCE, when the daughter of the Cleopatra that I was referring to, who talked to Onias and gave him permission to build a temple, another Cleopatra, I think this is Cleopatra the Third, brings into her employ the sons of Onias, Chalkias, Chalkiah, and Hananiah. Josephus tells us later in Book 13 of Antiquities that the two sons of Onias were the main generals of Cleopatra III in the late 2nd century BC. This is one of the most powerful positions you could have had in ancient Egypt and in Ptolemaic Egypt, which was itself one of the most powerful empires in the world at that time. So Chalkiah and Hananiah had enormous power. And when Cleopatra endures a rebellion by her own son, Ptolemy Lathyrus, the vast majority of Egyptians support her son against her. So we have Josephus here quoting a first century BCE Roman historian Strabo, who says that everyone pretty much in Egypt supported Ptolemy Lathyrus against his mother Cleopatra, except for the Jews. Chalkiah and Hananiah could not abandon the queen that they were so devoted to. And it might have been that out of gratitude for what her mother did for their father, Chaniah, Onias, they felt a loyalty that they could not surrender. And so Strabo says, the only people who really were helping Cleopatra out against her son Ptolemy Lathyrus were Chalkia and Hanania and the Jews who followed them. And so throughout the second century, the Jews are playing a very outward-facing role in the political turmoil that Egypt is undergoing. And you can imagine that not everybody liked this. The Jews, even though there were hundreds of thousands of them, they were still a minority in the broader Egyptian population, and they had a disproportionate amount of power. Now, I've included a lot of other sources, but there's so many intricate details in Josephus's description of this conflict that I'm not going to go through this line by line to explain all the ins and outs. But you could look at this on your own. It's quite complicated, but you could look at it on your own. Essentially, what's going on here is that the Jews in Judea had to choose between supporting Ptolemy Lathyrus, the son of Cleopatra, or Cleopatra, the mother, and the Jews in Judea, probably out of loyalty to the Jews in Egypt, take a major risk by supporting Cleopatra, the mother. And so this tells us that the Jews in Judea are taking into consideration the welfare of the Jews of Egypt and probably vice versa. Now I'm going to skip to the end of the first. This is, again, very complicated, and I wish I had many hours to go through all of this with you, but I do encourage you to look at it on your own. And I also tried to put in like little source, little footnotes over here to like give you some information about what's going on because it's confusing. But I want to skip to the late first century BCE. So I'm just going to give you a minute of historical background. Up until 63 BCE, we're living in the Hellenistic, the Greek world. And from 164 BCE to 63 BCE, Judea is autonomous, right? That's the Hasmonean kingdom. It lasts for exactly 100 years. But they're living in a broader context of Hellenism. In 63 BCE, everything changes because the Roman general Pompey invades Judea. And from that point on, Judea is under the yoke of Rome. Not completely. Only in 63 BCE, there's a sort of client-king relationship where the Romans put some Idumeans, Antipater, and then his son Herod in charge of Judea. But Antipater and Herod do not have real power. They report to the Romans. And the Romans choose them because the Idumeans have this weird Jew, non-Jew history. In the second century BCE, the Idumeans convert to Judaism when the Hasmonean monarchy is expanding. But if you know anything about this history, you know that the Jews don't consider Herod to be a real Jew. They're suspicious of him because those Idumeans converted mostly out of fear of the Hasmoneans. And so they weren't really considered to be totally integrated into the Jewish population. But the Romans say, well, Antipater, you're sort of Roman, but Jewish. You're an Idumean. You are going to be the client king of Judea. And then later his son. In 6 CE, Judea is fully incorporated into the Roman Empire. That's when the real trouble begins. Why am I saying all of this? Because as of 63 BC, the whole situation has changed, and now Judea is no longer autonomous. They're under Rome, but Rome is very unstable. And now I'm going to share my source sheet again. We have Julius Caesar vying for power against Mark Antony, and it's not clear to the Jews whom they should support. And the Jews in Judea have their own concerns versus the Jews in Egypt as well. So I'm not going to go through all of this, but just sort of cut to the chase. Originally, the Jews do not support Caesar. They support Pompey, his enemy. But early on in this conflict, they end up supporting Caesar. And you could read Josephus in such a way as to suggest that they actually enable his victory in Egypt. Antipater had put Jews on the border of Judea and Egypt to the point where they were acting as guards of the entrances to Egypt. And this becomes very important. The position of Jewish soldiers on the border, which separates Judea and Egypt, becomes very significant because there are also Jews who are in Egypt itself. When Caesar, I'm just going to read this because it's complicated. Caesar is victorious over Pompey. And Caesar is going to Egypt to conquer it. Antipater is now supporting Caesar. When Caesar first gets to Egypt, he is blocked by Jews who do not support him. But Antipater sends those Jews a message and they say, let Caesar pass. So here's the key passage. When Mithridates, who's another general who supports Caesar, and his buddy Antipater are on their way to Caesar, who's going to Egypt to conquer it, the Jews in the land of Anias prevented them. They say, no, we are not going to support you. We are not pro Caesar. And Antipater says, no, 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 you don't understand. If you're loyal to the Jews of Egypt, you have to embrace Caesar because we support him. Antipater persuaded the Jews of Egypt to let him pass. How did he do it? He shows these Jews in Egypt a letter from the high priest Hyrcanus to Hyrcanus was the son of Salome Alexandra and the terrible king Alexander Janaeus. But he was, again, I don't want to go through too many details, but he's the enemy of his very Hellenized apostate brother Aristobulus. Anyway, so the high priest Hyrcanus is like the good guy. He's a supporter of the Pharisees and the practice of ancestral Jewish law. And he supports Caesar, who ends up being very, very good to the Jews and really allows them to practice their ancestral law. Anyway, I know that I'm giving you a ton of information. I'm going to try to keep it simple. The point is that Antipater, the Idumean client king, shows a letter written by the high priest Hyrcanus in Jerusalem, of Jerusalem, telling the Jews of Egypt to let Julius Caesar pass. This defeat of Egypt is what tips the scale for Julius Caesar and ensures his victory and establishment as the sole emperor of the Roman Empire. So the way that Josephus presents it is that the Jews of Egypt and Judea had a major role in enabling Caesar to defeat his enemy, first Pompey and Mark Antony. Okay, I know that's a lot of history. Bottom line, the Jews had disproportionate political power in Egypt, right? Beginning with the early second century BCE, when Ananias's buddy with Ptolemy and Cleopatra, and they're letting him come in and build a temple and trusting him that he will be loyal to them. And he keeps that promise. Because then, somebody needs to make a film, Ananias's sons, Chilkiah and Hananiah, become the most important generals in the Egyptian army. And when Cleopatra III's son, Ptolemy Lathyrus, rebels against her, they're the only ones who support her, and they get the Judeans to support her too. The role of Egyptian Jews in terms of broader Greco-Roman politics is huge, and it caused a major, major resentment against the citizens of Alexandria who were furious by Jewish power. And I want to end with on a sad note, and that is that this led to incredible anti-Jewish violence between the years of 38 and 41 CE. Philo of Alexandria writes two treatises about what happened during these years. One is called On the Embassy to Gaius, and one is called For Flaccus. His description of the broken windows of the synagogues, the Torah scrolls lit on fire, the physical attacks on Jews in their homes. I'm sorry to say that it reads like Kristallnacht. And I don't have the time, again, to go through it line by line. You can find these texts online. I said earlier in the chat, the best edition of all these sources is the Loeb Classical Library, but unfortunately, that's not available for free online. You can get an older translation through the Perseus Tufts website. If you search, here, I'll put it into the chat. If you search Perseus Tufts Classical Library, it'll come up, but these translations are old. That's why they're in the public domain and they're free, so the translations are not good. I encourage you to find a translation of these treatises and read it. What happens to set up the pogroms is people are very upset about Jewish power in Alexandria, and the client king of Judea in 38 CE, known as Agrippa, is passing through the city from Rome, where he has some official business to attend to, and he's going to Jerusalem, and he stops in Alexandria. He knows that he's very unpopular because he is very, very close to the emperors of Rome. At that time, the emperor was Caligula. But Agrippa has a good relationship with the emperors and also the ones who preceded him, Claudius, Tiberius, Augustus, Julius. And so Agrippa knows that people view him as having disproportionate power in Rome. And so he's very careful when he goes to Alexandria. He says, I'm going to pass in through the night. I'm going to schedule it so I don't get off the boat until the middle of the night. I'm going to replenish some supplies. I'm going to get back into the boat before sunrise and leave. Somehow word gets out that he's in the city and violence erupts. By midday, there is mass chaos in Alexandria. And there's even a parade where the Alexandrians parade in effigy of Agrippa. Well, that's not an effigy, actually. I think Philo says it's the town fool. They put a king, they put a crown on his head, and they parade the town fool through the city, and they say, all hail King Agrippa. And it's just a nightmare. There are hundreds of people die. Thousands of people are driven out of the city. So I want to end with some of the sources that describe this incident. And I'm sorry again for the typos. Okay. So where am I going to start? Ordinary robbers, out of fear of being detected, the Alexandrians plundered the Jews of their furniture, their treasures, carried them off in broad daylight, displayed their booty to everyone. They met as if they inherited it fairly, right? They're just stealing from Jewish homes. And the Jews are fleeing. And if any of them had previously been left in other parts of the city, or if any had come in thither from the fields out of ignorance of the evils that had happened, like if any Jews were found in the wrong place at the wrong time, they were stoned, they were wounded with sharp tiles, these Jews were beaten on the most mortal parts of the body, on the head. The Alexandrians were out for blood just because of the visit of Agrippa to the city. And nobody intervened. The Roman procurator who was witnessing this at the time, Flaccus, let it happen, according to Philo. The Roman officials in the city stood by and watched as Jews were taken, they were bound, their ankles were fastened together, they were dragged through the middle of the marketplace. I mean, this is extremely hard to read, the tortures and horrors that they endured. And Philo sat back, and Flaccus sat back and did nothing. Now, Philo says, I was already on page 11 of the source sheet, so I didn't include more. Philo says that he went to Rome to ask for help. He went with a delegation of four other Jews to Rome to say, you have to intervene. Alexandria is in flames. There are hundreds of thousands of Jews right now who are fleeing for their lives or being violently attacked. And Caligula laughs him out of the court. Philo says, first, he was humiliated because the delegation was waiting and waiting and waiting. Caligula wouldn't see them. Finally, when he sees them, I think some of you have heard me say this in earlier classes because it's such a great story, but a shocking story. Caligula says, I don't have time for this Jewish delegation. I have to attend to my gardens. Now, if you want to walk with me through my gardens, I guess I could listen to what you have to say. So Philo describes how Caligula is walking through his gardens, giving instructions to his gardeners. Oh, cut those roses a little shorter, cut those flowers in this way, while Philo is sort of following along behind him, trailing him and saying, and another thing is happening to the Jews, and their synagogues have been burned down, and the Torah scrolls have been desecrated. And finally, Caligula turns around and says, you know what? It's not my problem. Not my problem. Can't help you. Sorry. And Philo and the Jewish delegation go back humiliated. Philo is a great example of Jewish optimism in Egypt because he truly believes that the Jews can make a positive difference and find a kind of peaceful, harmonious alliance with their Greek and Roman neighbors. But maybe he's too optimistic because it simply doesn't happen. The political success of the Jews in Egypt galvanizes too much animosity. And in 115, we have another uprising of violence known as the War of Ketos, which I don't have time to go into now because I want to leave time for conversation. But by 118, it seems that this conflict that arises between 115 and 118, where there's again anti-Jewish violence. This time the Jews do not sit back, they fight back, and then Rome comes back with a vengeance and kills thousands of Jews, not only in Alexandria, but throughout the Roman Empire. This might have been the end of the robust golden age of Jewish life in Alexandria. So it doesn't mean that there were no longer Jews in Alexandria after 118, but that really does mark the end of the golden age of those Jews. We're going to talk about that more in coming weeks. But what I wanted to emphasize for this, you know, very dense introduction is the Jews of Egypt, in the broadest sense, were incredibly successful politically, socially, and economically. And that posed a major challenge, a major difficulty theologically for Jews in the land of Israel. We're going to really address that problem in the last class of the series and talk about how Jews in Judea solved it. So now I'm going to look into the chat. There are a lot of comments. I haven't seen any of these comments. I haven't been reading. So I guess I'll look at a few now. Okay, so Baruch Sturman says, will you be talking about the Ethiopian Jewish community and the relationship to the Egyptian Jewish community in the Second Temple period? No, not really, because we don't have the evidence for that. But I will be talking about the various ancient Jewish communities in the first century. And those major ones are Leontopolis, Alexandria, and then earlier, we would say Elephantine. Where does burning of the library at Alexandria fit into this? It's a great question. There probably, scholars think that there was more than one fire at this point. There are debates about which one was the major one. It could have been anywhere from the first century BCE to the first century C, but it could be that there were phases of it. Its height was the third century BC and the second century BCE, but I did read recently that there could have been more than one fire. So I don't know what to say beyond that, except that it is, the Library of Alexandria is mentioned in Jewish sources, not the burning, but the library itself, in a very important source called the Letter of Aristeas, which describes the circumstances in which the Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek. And so the Library of Alexandria was considered a huge cultural touchstone for anybody who cared about intellectual life. It wasn't just a library. It was a place where philosophers gathered. It wasn't like the Skokie Library that I go to with my kids that has a cool children's room. The library was much more than just a place of books. It was a place where philosophers went to exchange discourse. And certainly Jews like Philo would have interacted with it. We don't have a lot. Well, I don't know of any Jewish sources that talk about its burning. We have Roman sources that talk about its burning. What about Jewish trading families in Egypt before the destruction of the temple? Oh, hold on. So much is coming. Okay. Jewish trading families in Egypt before the destruction of the temple from, say, the time of the judges. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'd have to see what text you're talking about. We do know that there are alliances with Egypt, but as far as I know, the earliest major Judean settlement in Egypt would be in 586. Well, that might not be true, but I would have to know what sources you're talking about. So help me out with that. They had military skills. All right, I can't answer every question. There's so much going on here. How much corroboration is there of Josephus' text? Okay, I'm going to answer this one. Josephus is really dismissed very often as an unreliable witness. And so I want to say a few things about that. there is no objective historian in the Roman world. Every history is polemical. The official histories that we have, let's say Suetonius or Tacitus or any, you know, even going back to the first century BCE, Cicero, let's say, you know, the great Roman orator, the greatest Roman intellectuals who give us historical information about this time are never objective. Josephus, likewise, is not objective. However, it pains me when people throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, Josephus, nothing is useful from Josephus. If I witness, I'm trying to think of something important, you know, this is a sad metaphor, but it's not a metaphor, but if I tell you something about my experience on the day of 9/11, and I say, 9/11 took place in, you know, in Los Angeles on March 10th, 1992, you'd be like, wait a second, that's not true. 9/11 is 9/11. We all know what happened on 9/11. Don't tell me it took place in Los Angeles in 1992. We were all there. When Josephus is writing the Jewish War in the late 70 CE, he can't lie because he's writing to people who experienced it. He's not writing about events that happened generations and generations earlier. So yes, he has his own interpretation of the Jewish War. He has 10 causes of the Jewish War, 5 of them blame the Jews and 5 of them blame the Romans. And you could tell he's walking that polemical tightrope where he doesn't want to be seen as too Roman by the Jews or too Jewish by the Romans. He's walking that polemical tightrope, but he's writing to an audience that knows the story. So we really have to respect that. Now, when it comes to Antiquities of the Jews, it's a much more complicated question because he's starting from the book of Genesis and he's going all the way through in 20 volumes to his present day. But even there, he's using sources. And we know that because other contemporaneous first century Roman historians probably shared some of those sources. And so is he objective? By no means is he objective. But it pains me when people just say, oh, Josephus, traitor. And I can say more about what happened to Josephus and why he's accused of being so traitorous. But I do think that he needs to be taken very, very seriously, especially in the 7-volume work, The Jewish War, very seriously. I always defend Josephus. I don't know how that happens. Yeah, there's zero mention of Egypt in the book of Judges. That question confused me because I just didn't know what source, but it's very, very possible that there are sources that I don't know about. So send me an email and then I'll address it next week. Idris, this is a very long question and I have to wrap up in 3 minutes, but I'm going to try to do this. Okay, we have much discussion regarding Jews and their cultural blending with Romans and Greeks, but how did they interact with native Egyptians? This is a great question. I'm really glad that I read it, even though it was 6 lines. Great question. I've seen some scholars claim there was no interaction. That's not true, but I've seen other contradict this as well. Yes. Okay. So this is a really interesting question because there were native Egyptians in Egypt and there's a lot of what we call racism against those native Egyptians. And you find that racism in Greek and Roman sources and also in Jewish sources. And so Philo sometimes will say, oh, this biblical figure, when he's talking about in some of his biblical interpretations, Philo will say, this biblical figure was as ugly as an Egyptian or as dark as an Egyptian. So Philo was quite, yeah, I see some of you are like, oh boy. Yeah. And so Greeks and Romans also looked at Egyptians in the same way that you might have racism, like very unfortunate, problematic racism against indigenous people today, or you might say they're less sophisticated, they're less cultivated, and they've lived in the land longer than us. There is like a certain kind of triumphalism, or you might even say colonialism, but there is a lot of bias against the native Egyptians in the first century, especially in terms of physical appearance, but also in terms of their attachment to ancient practices. Okay, so what else do I want to say about that? So then just one thing, which is if you think about sort of like the class hierarchy in the first century, when the Romans come into Egypt, right, with Julius Caesar at the end of the first century BC, and they push the hierarchy down. So the Greeks were once at the top, and then it was Jews are somewhere in the middle, and then the Egyptians are at the bottom. The Romans come in and they push that down. And so then the Romans are in charge, then you have the Greeks, and then you have the Egyptians all the way at the bottom. And then the Jews, the place of the Jews is always in question because they have political power, but they're also criticized in a very sometimes similar manner as the Egyptians. They cling to irrational ancestral laws. They're misanthropic. They do their own thing. They don't integrate. And so the question of where the Jews fit into that hierarchy is always a question. And so to answer your very interesting question, what some of the Jews do is they push the Egyptians down to establish themselves as being higher class. There's some interesting scholarship on Philo's attitude towards native Egyptians that you can find. All right, I think I have to wrap up because it is 10:30 Chicago time, 6:30 Israel time. And this was a lot of fun. Thank you all for joining me. I'm going to put my email once again into the chat. And you can always shoot me an email. Sometimes it takes a couple days for me to get back to you, but I welcome your impressions. And come to class next week. with any questions or anything you need clarified, I'd be happy to address those. So have a wonderful week and a wonderful Shabbat.